Accession number 15735, Reel 2.
Mr. Ferret, Reel 2.
The $4 was the weekly pay they gave us extra to our ordinary Navy pay, which really went nowhere in Canada at the time. These girls took us bowling and to the food, of course, was marvellous. First time we'd seen anything like a T-bone steak. And I always remember my friend, he just could not face it. It was too much for him. But eventually the minesweeper was ready, and we had the experience of sailing all down through the Great Lakes. You go between Detroit and Windsor, and on down, you eventually come to the Welland Ship Canal, which bypasses Niagara. And anyone who had 50 cents could take a short bus ride to Niagara while we were in one of the various locks. I'm still to see Niagara, I'm afraid, because I didn't have 50 cents at the time. And we just came then across to the Azores, and which was a dreadfully rough trip in a minesweeper, only three or four of us eating in our particular mess. And the other signalman, he was incapable. I just spent all day on the bridge going down for meals. Not that I think we only saw one other ship the whole passage. It came on from the Azores into Plymouth and then round to Rosyth, and it all sent back to barracks.
This was after the Japanese war had ended?
That was after the Japanese war had ended. And then I had a period there in Mercury, and was sent to John Brown's yard in Glasgow to join the Theseus, an aircraft carrier. It's one of the smaller aircraft carriers. And we used to do flying training, of course, with the RNAS, and eventually we went back up to Rosyth, and we were based there doing flying training with new pilots landing on, which was quite exciting, and also training the batsmen that these expert pilots would fly around doing silly things and try and get the batsmen to get it right. Previous to this, one landing, I had an unpleasant experience. Myself and another signalman were changing speed flags, because we always had an attendant destroyer in those days to pick up any of the planes that, or try and rescue pilots, whatever. And this plane came into land, made a hash of it, and crashed into the superstructure above us. There was burning debris coming down on us, so the other signalman, he went into the water. I thought, well, I'm not going into the water. There are some oil pipes on a rack about 15 feet down. I just dropped onto those and got my fingers and forehead singed a bit, and that was that. Made my way back up to the bridge. I couldn't get onto the flag deck itself, of course, because they're still fighting the fire up there. But to some extent, I think I lost my Navy nerve at that time. I was always a bit worried with planes coming in to land after that, because, I mean, it was quite fascinating to watch them from the flag deck. And, of course, there were several incidents. In those days, you didn't have an angled deck. All you had was your arrestor wires, and they didn't always make it. And the number of planes that went into the barrier, these steel hawser barriers, were no odds to anybody. The expense for the Navy must have been fantastic. But eventually we went with the Glory, another aircraft carrier of the same type, to the Far East, and we did the usual through the Suez Canal, had some time in Trincomalee, and then they decided that we should go on to Australia to show off the carriers, because Australia were thinking of buying some, to the Australian Navy, and which was a marvellous trip, really. I mean, they made it a social call at the various ports we went to, starting with Hobart in Tasmania, then to Melbourne, Port Phillip, where we did some demonstrations with a lot of Australian Navy top brass aboard, and lost two of our planes which collided in midair. And from Melbourne to Sydney, and after 11 days, I think, more or less enjoying the delights of Sydney, we had a big combined exercise with the Australian Navy. And the flying conditions were not particularly good, and the theory at the time was that the pilots had all perhaps enjoyed themselves too much over the previous 11 days, and we had a series of disasters with all these Australian Navy bigwigs on board. I don't know what they thought of it, because I think we lost three or four planes, and certainly some pilots at the same time, and thereafter all flying was cancelled. We had one more visit to Brisbane for another period of about 10 or 11 days, no flying. And from there we went over to Auckland, first to Wellington. One of my claims to fame was that I spotted the Mount Egmont from about 68 miles away, because it was, of course, considerable higher. I think it was about 8,000 feet or something like that. And nobody believed that I could see it. I said, land, you know, reported this. Nobody believed me to begin with, and then they realised it was. But we had a nice few days in Wellington, and then on to Auckland, where after a few days, more or less rest and visits ashore, we started flying training, and the pilots were all in good fettle by then, and we had no more losses, I'm pleased to say. We went from there north to Hong Kong via the Solomon Islands. We stopped there, I think, over one or two nights, but nobody really went ashore. And from there, straight on to Hong Kong. It was at that point that they decided to reduce the Far East fleet and to spread around the crews where necessary between the existing flotilla of small ships already based in Hong Kong. And of course we'd only been abroad then for 9 months, if that. I can't remember the exact timing, but I was the one who went to the Amethyst together with a couple of other colleagues.
When would this have been, do you think?
Round about the November 47. I can check that and let you know later, probably. From there on, it was just a series of trips to Singapore. As I was explaining earlier, we did a lot of trips around the coast of Malaya, visiting Penang, Kuala Lumpur, Kelantan, Kota Baru. And main purpose was to stop any smuggling of arms. We would stop fishing vessels and search them, sending a small armed party aboard them. We never found any arms, but we did end up with some free fish very often. From there we would go back to Hong Kong, and we did have one other trip, and that was to Japan. I don't remember the exact date, but I know it was winter. And the Americans were very much in occupation. You could do no shopping. You couldn't go to the American PX unless you had the American script dollars, or if you could take something of value to the Japanese ashore, like a bar of Navy soap, large 2-inch square bar, and you could exchange that for all sorts of things. I exchanged one for a Japanese tea set.
I think you said its nickname was Puss as Hard.
Puss as Hard. That's the nickname for these bars of soap. And we went to various ports. Sasebo, I remember. There were a couple of others. I don't remember the names of now, but we did end up at Yokohama, which from there we went straight back to Hong Kong. Fascinating going into Hong Kong at various times because of all the Chinese sampans. There'd be hundreds, literally hundreds of them, and you'd sail through all this lot and make quite a sight. And of course, in the Hong Kong harbour itself, they're always moored there, and they're always coming round trying to peddle their wares or offering to do washing and things like this. Hong Kong was a nice base.
How did you find the attitude of the Chinese and Hong Kongers compared with the Japanese in Japan?
Well, to us, the Chinese didn't seem as friendly as the Japanese. Whether the Japanese were being ultra polite or whether it was just their normal character, I'm not sure, but or possibly the fact that they were a defeated nation and felt they had to kowtow to everyone, I don't know. But never felt that you could get really friendly with the Japanese. Not that we had the opportunity to get friendly with the Japanese to that extent, but that was how it appeared to us at the time. We did one trip up to Nanking to act as guardship for the British embassy there, take up stores and supplies. There was always one naval ship there on these duties. I don't remember a great deal about that first visit, because apart from going ashore to play football, I don't think we actually went out visiting in the town on ordinary shore leave. And you did this for a month and then back down to Hong Kong.
Were conditions at all disturbed?
I can't really recall because, as I say, we had very little contact with the shore. We had one or two people come aboard from the embassy, but as to the actual conditions, the people were living in. This was, of course, some months prior to the actual incident, so I can't really comment on conditions there. Then, of course, we were in Hong Kong. We had quite a major change of crew. I was already overdue to go home myself, and a lot of my friends went home on a troop ship, and we had a virtually new crew, and we went on this trip first to Shanghai, and we had a few days there. I remember playing football. The only time I've ever played for the Navy, but that was only because there were only two ships in harbour. But the next day, we started on our trip up the Yangtze. You were not allowed to sail overnight. I think it would have probably been a bit treacherous anyway, although I think we had a Chinese pilot. And we anchored at some point up the river overnight. And then the next morning, of course, we were going on our way. Excuse me. And we suddenly realized we're being fired on. All these first few shots missed, and we thought, oh, it's just someone having a go. But we went on, and probably a quarter of an hour or so later, then the real attack opened up on us, and one of the first shells, I'm not sure whether it actually hit the wheelhouse or whether it was part of the shell that hit the bridge and injured the captain, but the helmsman, the coxswain, was hit, and as a result, he fell over to port side, well, hanging on to the wheel, taking it with him, so that the ship ended up aground. Because of the firing, we were hugging the south bank of the river as near as we could to try and keep out of range, but there's no way we could do. And as I say, before we knew where we were a sitting duck. And we were under some very accurate fire. I'd been on the flag deck when that shell landed in the wheelhouse with four or five other people. We were on the starboard side looking towards the north bank, and immediately the shell hit, we all piled round the port side of the ship and landed on the deck. And of course, by the time we'd got back to our feet again, the ship was already aground. It was as quick as that. This is to the best of my recollection anyway. There was nothing I could do from a duty point of view, so the firing was still going on. I eventually went down below. There were already some people dead lying around from other hits, and wounded being brought down. And then for some reason the wounded were taken towards the quarterdeck, and there were several wounded there, and I went aft and I was helping the doctor and the sick berth attendant, and the doctor told me to put a splint on the coxswain's leg. This was the one who had been in the wheelhouse, and which I did to the best of my ability, which subsequently didn't prove to be very good, because sometime later, after we'd come ashore and I'd visited the wounded in hospital in Hong Kong, saw the coxswain there. He said, oh, some idiot put a splint on my leg, and it was absolutely useless. I didn't let on at the time, but on our first reunion I did confess to him that I was the, I was the idiot concerned. And anyway, I did all I could there, and the doctor and the sick berth attendant went back forward to see if there were any other wounded to deal with. I stayed on the quarterdeck for some time with the wounded there, but it was unfortunate because they were actually open to the communists. They were actually facing back to the communists. And of course, because of going into the bank, the front two turrets couldn't be brought round to bear astern. And it was only the X gun, the twin 4-inch gun, 4.5-inch guns at the rear, the stern, that was able to fire, and they were only firing by hand. I think the controls had gone. Anyway, I went back inside the ship, and nobody knew really what to do. Some people had already got ashore by boat. I don't know why or how, but they'd managed to. There was Carly Rafts and one boat. I think the boat was holed eventually. And Lieutenant Berger, who subsequently became an admiral, of course, he came down to the deck. He had been wounded himself, and he called for a dozen volunteers. We all volunteered, but he just took the nearest dozen and told the rest of us to make our way to the shore. I got into the water and started swimming. I wasn't a particularly strong swimmer, but I was keeping up. I saw, you could see machine gun bullets, splashes coming across the water towards you, which wasn't very pleasant. And I also saw one chap to my left go under. There's no way I could have done anything for him to help him at all. And there was a Carley raft heading for the shore ahead of me. I yelled out to them to hang on, and otherwise I don't think I'd have made it. And we eventually crawled up the bank, and apart from some, I think, one or two machine gun bullets flying around, we were all okay there. There was a bank, and we could lie down the other side. And we just stayed there. We were getting, more people were coming off the ship. I think about 60 or so actually came ashore at the time, you know, doing what they were told, as it were. And eventually a nationalist soldier came and led us through. Apparently there were minefields and there were paddy fields, and I think there was a lot of water around. And took us inland. We had one or two fairly lightly wounded people with us, but we ended up that night in a barn. Meanwhile, of course, we didn't know at the time, but the consort had been warned of what was happening, had come down from Nanking and made an attempt to tow the Amethyst off, but herself became a sitting duck and had to abandon the attempt. And we stayed in this barn, tried to sleep there overnight, and we were taken to a Chinese restaurant, nothing like you find here, the next morning for breakfast, and it consisted of all sorts of peculiar dishes. We didn't really recognize any of it. Some people ate something, but that was about it. And we were eventually put on a train down to Shanghai. And once there, we were farmed out to British families still in the still in Shanghai. And I ended up with a businessman, another chap and myself, and we were treated extremely well. We were more or less, the Chinese boy was given the whiskey bottle and told to more or less keep us supplied with it. And we had a couple of days there. Then eventually they gathered us all in and took us back aboard the London, which of course, unknown to us, had been up the river, I think, the following day with the Black Swan in an attempt to rescue the Amethyst. But again, had come under heavy fire and had lost people themselves. But being a cruiser, as I understand it, she did quite a tremendous amount of damage in her efforts with her armament. I've never heard actually what happened, of course, you're not likely to, but I believe they made a very valiant attempt. And then they realised that they were going to come under too heavy fire to attempt to even get the Amethyst off, and turned in the river, which with a cruiser that size must have been a sight to see, turning, doing a full circle, more or less at fairly high speed. But of course we knew nothing of this until we were back aboard the London. One or two of the crew didn't treat us very well because they'd had casualties themselves and they thought we were to blame, which of course wasn't really. That's not really strictly true. I mean, we were given all the help we wanted, but we did get one a feeling that, you know, this is all your fault, sort of. They'd lost people, but then that's all part of the incident. Eventually, the London was relieved by the Belfast, and I had a further spell aboard her. And eventually put ashore in Hong Kong, where, as I say, I visited the wounded up in the Naval Hospital. And finally caught the next troop ship home. I was actually at home on leave when the Amethyst broke out of the river on, I think it was about the 3rd of August, 49. And of course I was very delighted by that. And I was subsequently able to take, meanwhile I went to the Maidstone, the submarine depot ship down at Portland, was serving aboard her. My effects turned up in a vast wooden box, and there was just this suitcase with anything of any value had gone, I don't mind saying, because I had a watch I'd bought from a brother and things like that. So I'm not blaming by the people who were left behind. I think somewhere in transit, probably. One or two other things, including the Japanese tea set, that all vanished. I mean, it may have been damaged anyway, you know, who knows. And as I say, I got home, and I was on leave, back to the Maidstone submarine depot ship, which was quite a quiet job, of course, there. And I was invited down to Plymouth to take part in the celebrations there, and also those subsequently in London. It was at that time that we met, because Edna was staying with an aunt of mine. We're both distantly related, and she happened to be in Portsmouth at this aunt at the time, and we got this invitation for the Dorchester. I had no other girlfriend, and the parents weren't particularly interested in actually coming to the Dorchester do. So I wrote and asked Edna, much to, I think her parents were extremely worried at the time, but anyway. She came and enjoyed it. My father actually came to Buckingham Palace, where we went and saw the Queen and King, the princesses, and Jack French got his medal and all that. And it was quite an enjoyable few days up there.